Haiti has a new prime minister. Congress could move to help the Everglades. And teaching high schoolers how to look for concussion symptoms. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Haiti is in economic freefall. Last week, the president announced the appointment of a new prime minister. But can this move help turn the course for the island nation? Also, algal blooms are taking a toll on Florida's economy. Congress may be close to passing legislation that could initiate the construction of a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. Plus, if your child suffered a concussion during something like a high school football game, would you know? We talked with the head of concussion studies at the University of Miami about why players aren't the only ones that need to be informed.
There are definitely some parents that, you know, just have trouble accepting that their child has had this injury, which you can't see.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Haiti remains in economic turmoil, but within the last week, the island nation got a new prime minister, Jean-Henri Seyoum. Earlier this summer, fuel prices went up to 51%, and that led to riots in the capital. So does this move, this new prime minister, help stabilize Haiti? We spoke with Jacqueline Charles of the Miami Herald, and we started by asking, who is Seyoum?
Well, Jean-Henri Seyoum, who was just ratified as Haiti's newest prime minister, he is best known as a public notary in Haiti, but in fact, he's also an attorney and he also teaches law at one of the universities there. He is a two-time presidential contestant who lost both times when he ran. He ran in the most recent election that was held in Haiti, and he ran under this party called Remy Aitzi, Love Haiti. And he was recently tapped to be prime minister following the resignation, or I should say the forced resignation, of former Prime Minister Jacques Guy Lafontaine.
What have we heard about Seyoum from the Haitian expat community here in Miami?
I have to tell you, the Haitian expat community here in Miami, you know, they're really not as engaged with Haiti as they have been in years past, just because, you know, they watch the politics, they see what has happened, and really a lot of people don't feel that you get a new prime minister and that is going to change things or shake things up. More and more people are seeing that the problems of Haiti is not so much the personalities, although, you know, one can argue they don't necessarily make things better, but it's the structure. So they're basically giving it a wait and see. I mean, you have to remember, this is a guy who ran for president. He didn't win. He didn't finish in the top two or the top three. So you have to ask yourself, in terms of a prime minister, how much change will he be able to do and how much will come about? And that was a huge question for some of the members of the opposition in the parliament during his ratification. It says, you know what, I like you personally, but I really don't feel that, you know, you're going to bring about serious change and the kinds of change that Haiti needs.
Why did it take this long for the government to pick a new prime minister?
Well, you know, in Haiti, you know, Haitian politics, as a friend of mine said, I mean, just let's think about this ratification vote. The Senate started at 3:45 p.m. on a Friday, and they took the final vote at 7 a.m. Saturday morning, and that was 28 members. And then later that day, they started the ratification process over in the lower chamber, where you have 117 members. So they did a marathon session, basically doing this in a 48-hour period, but yet it took months. I mean, there's always deal-making, negotiating. I've heard that with Seyoum that he, or supporters of his, say that he didn't even get two members in this cabinet, in this ministerial cabinet that he now controls. So, yeah, things move slow in Haiti, even when they need to move quickly.
Remind us the role of the prime minister in a nation like Haiti. And is this is not an elected position?
No, it's not. So it's very much based on the French system. You have a president, which is Jovenel Moïse, and then you have a prime minister, which would be something akin to a vice president. But the prime minister is selected by the president, but he has to be ratified, or at least his political program has to be ratified by parliament. You know, what people have wanted in the past is some sort of a balance, not necessarily somebody who's going to be a yes man to the president. The prime minister is the one who runs the government. You know, people always talk about in Haiti, you know, the president is minor, meaning that his name doesn't appear anything. He doesn't really sign anything. But the person who decides how the money is spent, where the money should be spent, who signs, you know, the contracts, who issues those contracts, it is the prime minister, and he's control of a cabinet. So that cabinet can be an 18-member ministerial cabinet, meaning there are 18 ministers, as we have now with Jean Rissien. And then there are a number of secretaries of state. These are just lower ministers who are in charge of things like, you know, for handicapped persons. So that is the control of the government. That is the government. So when we say in Haiti the government has resigned, the government is not functioning, it means that the prime minister has basically left the building or today cannot sign any new contracts, engage in anything new, and you have to bring in a new prime minister that now has the authority of parliament, because the prime minister answers to parliament. Well, let me say, he is supposed to answer to parliament and not the president. Unfortunately, it doesn't work out that way.
Let's go back to earlier this summer. Haiti's former prime minister, Jacques Lafontaine, raised gas prices, and this was during the World Cup. Why did he have to raise them as high as he did, almost 51%?
The highest was 51%. That was for kerosene, which is the fuel of the poor. Haiti had entered into an agreement with the IMF, International Monetary Fund. Basically, they went to the IMF and says, listen, we're broke. We don't have any money. We have a huge deficit, and we have a lot of challenges. We have to pay our teachers. We have to pay our public service workers. We have to get money for schools. So we need money. We need international aid. Can you help us? The IMF says, listen, we're willing to help, and other donors are willing to help, but you first need to bring your books in order. I can't agree to lend you money or have other donors, the U.S. and others, lend you money when you are giving away money at the pump. What does that mean? It means that Haiti has been subsidizing gas prices for years. The prices that they should be charging, they were not charging. So they're buying it at market value, they're keeping it low at the pump, and they were basically giving money away. So the IMF says you need to bring your gas prices in line with market prices. As an example, across the border in the Dominican Republic, every time gas prices go up globally, the price at the pump goes up globally. When prices go down, they go down. That is part of their law. In Haiti, that would not happen. But it was more how they did it. You know, to raise gas prices by 51%, 38% overnight, the population said, We can't take this. And just to give you an example of how that plays out, if you take a mother who has two kids and those kids take public transportation, and just say they take one bus from their home in Pétionville to Port-au-Prince, which really isn't that far, and she's making less than $5 US a day, because that's what somebody who works as a maid at a hotel or domestic work or even at a factory would probably be getting paid. Almost half of her daily wages will be going to transportation for her kids. So where is money for food? Where is money for rent? Where is money for anything else? And this is why you got the reaction that you received from the population. The people were just angry. They were frustrated. Things are going up. Prices are going up. Things are not getting better.
I'm talking with Jacqueline Charles. She covers Haiti for the Miami Herald. Haiti recently appointing a new prime minister, Jean-Henri Saint. Jacqueline, how do Haitians, not just in Haiti, but here in Florida, in the United States, feel about the job that current President Jovenel Moïse is doing?
Well, right now, President Jovenel Moïse is not receiving a lot of positive feedback. I mean, even from his own supporters in the parliament. There was a very impassioned speech by a Senator Kitler Augustin during the ratification process, who basically said to Jean Rissien, are you prepared to tell the president that his strategy is not working? The president has basically put everything in what he calls the caravan of change. It's essentially a public works program. You're putting everything in this. At the same time, the local currency is depreciating rapidly. Today, it's 71 Haitian goods to one U.S. dollars. What that means is that people have less buying power, and it's even gotten worse since the July riots. At the same time, we've got, you know, Haitians who have been leaving. You know, they were going in Chile. Those who have been returning can't find jobs. You've got this issue of TPS here in the United States. The economy is not moving. The economy actually today is very expensive. Just on the phone this morning with a friend who says that he went to purchase rice, so like a 50-pound bag of rice, and it was like $55 Haitian dollars. And then 2 days later, the prices had gone up to 75 Haitian dollars, and he was told that the price is going to continue to go up. So this is what the average Haitian is dealing with on the ground, and Haitians in the diaspora who are supporting them, this is what they are also dealing with. So, no, right now, President Jovenel Moïse is not getting any positive reviews from either the Haitian diaspora or a lot of Haitians in Haiti.
Are they having a currency crisis?
It's not so much of a currency crisis as it has been a ongoing rapid depreciation of their local currency because of the economy. And earlier this year, Haiti decided that it has to be in using the local currency when actually the Haitian economy is very dollarized. So you have a country that's not exporting a lot or very little, but it's importing almost everything. So it's beyond a currency crisis. A currency crisis is we need to do something to fix it. This is an economic crisis that it goes into your macro, micro, economic, and the structures that you have put in place, and that you have an economy that's based more on imports and exports.
And we talk about money, and Haiti is actually looking for missing money. I think it was $2 billion that's linked to Venezuela oil money. I mean, what's happening there?
Yes. Yeah, so Haiti, as of the 2010 earthquake, owes Venezuela about $2 billion. They are in debt, about $2 billion. And that is essentially as a result of the discounted oil program that they were involved with Venezuela, where Venezuela sells them oil at a discounted price. And they may just pay a small fraction of that, and they pay the rest of that over a 25-year period. So Haitians in the diaspora and in Haiti are asking, what happened to Petrocaribe? What happened to this $2 billion that we are indebted for? What has it purchased? What has it done? So you walk around downtown Port-au-Prince, you see a lot of buildings that are half built and they're at a standstill. You look at the fact that you still have thousands of people living in tent cities 8 years after the quake. You hear about contracts that were paid out, but nothing was built. And so what has happened in the last couple of weeks is that there's been a social media campaign by a lot of young Haitians, a lot of them living in a diaspora, and this thing has now taken off, that even the average politician in Haiti today can't ignore the fact that Petrocaribe is the number one issue in that country, and Haitians are demanding accountability from current and past government leaders in this anti-corruption campaign.
Obviously, one of the big things is TPS is going to be ending soon for Haitians. I mean, we have this economic crisis, in Haiti. All of this, I mean, what has been the Trump administration's attitude towards Haiti and all of these challenges and issues?
Well, as you recently read in the Miami Herald, it was reported in the new book, Fear, by Woodard, that when President Trump, or when he was candidate Trump, was here in Little Haiti to meet with the Haitian community to ask for their support, that he allegedly used the "it hole" comment to refer to the country. And so one can say that kind of sums up his attitude toward Haiti. I mean, at the end of the day, TPS is going to end in July of next year, absent any changes in anything that happens. And you have Haitians today who are going to have to decide what they're going to do. Are they going to stay? Are they going to go? What are they going to do with their American-born children who basically have been educated in an English-only system and now have to go to a French and Creole system? If you have a kid that's 12 years old, that's a huge question, because that child will basically have to turn back a couple of grades in order to catch up. I mean, the schools in Haiti where, you can get an education in English or a U.S.-based education, they're expensive. You know, they're over $15,000 a year. And a lot of these people can't afford that, and they're not going to be able to make that kind of money in Haiti, because the jobs that they're doing here, they don't translate over there. And if they do, they're certainly not getting paid $15 or even $10 an hour. You're getting $5 a day, $7 a day.
And again, that was Jacqueline Charles, who covers Haiti for the Miami Herald. We'll have a link to her story up on our Facebook page so you can read more about their new prime minister. Well, still to come, is Congress going to move to help Everglades restoration? And how is it going to impact tourism here in Florida? The red tide, of course, that's what we're talking about. All that coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the algal blooms throughout the state of Florida have devastated our tourist economy, fisheries, and agriculture. I mean, they're seeing red tides now up in the panhandle. And all this comes back to the Everglades. Fortunately, support from the federal government could be on its way. Last week, the House of Representatives passed the Water Resources Development Act. Included in the legislation is the authorization of a new reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. Environmental groups like the Everglades Foundation see the reservoir as an opportunity to divert the harmful overflows from Lake Okeechobee causing those red tides. The president of the foundation, Eric Eichenberg, joins us now in studio. Eric, great to see you again.
Luis, thank you for having me.
First, let's break down what exactly is included in this legislation. The House passed last week, it's going to the Senate. Are we talking about financing to develop the new reservoir? Is it just to put things into motion? What happens now?
Right. Oh, well, it's approval. It's Congress taking the step to authorize the project. So once the Senate takes that up and approves it like the House did, as you mentioned, then we get moving towards ensuring the money flows to build it. So we need Congress to authorize, to approve. Next step is to get the money to actually build it.
And there's federal money, but there's also the state money,
there
too.
There is, okay. Yes. Everglades restoration over the last 18 years, it is a 50-50 partnership between the state of Florida and the United States Congress. So for every dollar that Florida and our tax dollars go toward this important restoration effort, Washington matches it one for one.
What does this reservoir do? Why is it so important?
Well, we're seeing, again, now the third summer in the last 5 years where rainfall increases the water level within Lake Okeechobee. And when it hits 14, 14 and a half, 15 feet, the only option today that's given to the Army Corps of Engineers, the colonel who sits in Jacksonville, is to open the gates on the east and west side of the lake itself. And billions of gallons of fresh water is dumped down the St. Lucie and the Caloosahatchee. And the concern there is you have a 70-plus-year-old Herbert Hoover dike. And the Corps is worried after Hurricane Katrina that these dikes and these dams are concerned for breach. So you have 110,000 fellow Floridians that reside south of Lake Okeechobee. And when that water level hits to a level of the safety and welfare of those residents, that's when the dumping of this water, and to add insult to injury, this water is polluted. Hence, we're seeing the algae and the crisis we have again.
And we see the images over and over again of that thick green sludgy water. It's like guacamole,
yes,
as some people call it. And again, now we're seeing the impacts along the east and west coast, impacting a lot of beaches, a lot of business. How does the reservoir stop that?
So once the reservoir is built, back to the scenario of water filling up in Lake Okeechobee, the colonel then has a new outlet. The colonel can open the gate to the south, send lake water into the reservoir, which is right there in the 500,000 acres of sugarcane fields. The water will be stored in that lake. You can't send polluted water then into the Everglades. And the good news is we have roughly 65,000 acres of man-made wetlands. I like to call them the kidneys of the Everglades. So the polluted water, mainly phosphorus, gets cleansed within those kidneys, and then you're delivering important fresh water through the peninsula down to South Florida and the Keys.
So, to come back and maybe to play a little bit of the devil's advocate is, this is stuff that's been talked about for a long time.
Yes.
Yes, we know government can work very slowly. But you know what? The algal blooms, they're happening now, and people are feeling it now. So, I mean, really, realistically, what do you think happens next? How long does this take?
Well, quite frankly, I'm more optimistic today as I sit here and chat with you about this than I was maybe even 5 or 6 years ago. And here's why. We have been at this now for a couple decades, and realtors, anglers, those that rely on the fishing industry, boat manufacturers, small business owners along the coast who are being impacted by the way we manage water today, they have stood up and said, enough. We have to solve this problem. So the science is settled. We have a plan. That comprehensive plan that Congress passed 18 years ago is what we are modeling off of our actions today. What has been missing up until, I would argue, 2016, was the political will to actually do it. And that crisis during that summer led to the effort of getting a reservoir south of the lake, a reservoir that just wasn't planned, a reservoir that's been talked about, again, for 18 years. So you never let a good crisis go to waste. And this is unfortunate because people are suffering. But the politicians, both in Tallahassee and in Washington, are hearing it directly. These infrastructure projects need to be built. They need to be built timely, and they need to come online so we can solve this problem.
You know what? Help us understand the relationship between the South Water Management District and the Army Corps of Engineers.
They are partners in this. So we have two agencies, a state agency and a federal agency, that are authorized, that have the authority to build these massive infrastructure projects. So they work in tandem. The bureaucracy at the Army Corps can sometimes be stifling, so we need to make sure that the federal government's not holding it up, and the Water Management District, in their mission, has the authority to make sure the Everglades is restored, and they need to also be held accountable to make that happen.
And I misspoke, South Florida Water Management District now, but when it comes to releasing that water, it is
Army
solely
Corps.
On the Army
it's
Corps.
It's on the Army Corps due to the health and safety of the residents around the lake, but that is a federal decision to lift those gates. But again, back to the issue of the water being polluted in Okeechobee, it's the state responsibility to ensure of water quality. So when we have all this pollution pouring into the lake from the north, it's the state of Florida, the legislature, the governor, responsible to make sure we have clean water flowing into the lake, and we have water flowing south down to the Keys that is also meeting water quality standards.
I'm talking with Eric Eichenberg, president of the Everglades Foundation. We're talking about the Water Resources Development Act, passed the House and is awaiting a vote in the Senate. The act includes language that would authorize the construction of a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, as Eric has been telling us. And this could be a big solution for dealing with the harmful red and green algal blooms. Again, as we have to dump water out of the lake east and west, it is polluted water, and it is causing a lot of problems. You know, the Water Management District recently presented an alternative solution for addressing these overflows. Mass injection wells to the east and west of the reservoir. They're calling them emergency estuary protection wells. What is that?
Well, it's in search of a unicorn. What first came to mind is a different shade of red on the lips of a pig. The issue here is we are dumping billions of gallons of water east and west. This is just the solution out of sight, out of mind. We're going to dump it 3,000 feet.
It's building wells to dump that polluted water down into is what we're...
But what water managers are not thinking about is there will be a drought. South Florida will suffer a drought. We don't know when, but it is certainly going to happen. We've had drought for decades. So we're dealing with too much water now, and you can't store yourself out of a flood. But we do know that when we have drought, these reservoirs, these massive infrastructure projects to hold water on the peninsula, will enable water to flow south, recharging the aquifer for 8 million of us that reside in South Florida, our drinking water, and then get this water down to Florida Bay and the Florida Keys for tourism. So this idea that was discussed last Thursday, if we went that direction, it's estimated to cost $400 million.
When you heard that, though, I mean, did you talk to the Water Management District about this? Okay.
And we have. Our science team had a conversation with their technical folks a number of months ago. We raised some. There's a lot of unknown about the impact of the volume of this type of water going down into what's called the boulder zone. My, not being a scientist, but understanding sort of what we've been dealing with, my first reaction was, how does this impact our water supply? You're going to take toxic, polluted water and put it near the aquifer that we tap into for drinking water. We see what happens in Flint, Michigan, when you have lead in a water supply and folks can still not drink the water in Flint. We don't need a Flint, Michigan here. We have a plan. Keep the water on the peninsula, store it, send it south, make sure it occurs.
Were they talking about having test wells, though, to try this?
They were going
to
test it. You have wells. There are wells today that are operating, but it is a small fraction of the amount of water that the Water Management District is calling for within these wells. They're calling for 100 wells north of Lake Okeechobee, taking 7 to 10 years to potentially build out, costing $400 million. We don't need a chase.
So what is their take? What did they say to you about, well, what these wells were for if we could get the money from the federal government and build this reservoir? I mean, why have the wells then?
You're not going to receive money from the federal government to do the wells that they're contemplating today. What they need to realize is the Everglades Restoration Plan that was passed by Congress in 2000 has a component called Aquifer Storage and Recovery, ASR. And those ASR wells would allow for a portion of that water that's stored to come back up to be dealing with issues of drought. The Army Corps of Engineers has a report out that says the aquifer storage and recovery wells that were envisioned a number of years ago may not be as reliable as once thought of. So there's a lot of unknowns about these wells and dumping all this water into the earth.
It seems like maybe it's just a faster solution right now.
But it's not. It's not going to solve the problem tomorrow. Quite frankly, there is no solution tomorrow. What we have to do is ensure that this reservoir, once it's authorized and signed, we have the money to fund it, to build it. The next governor of this state needs to commit to having that reservoir built within that first term. It needs to be online within a 4-year time frame. It's the same agency, Luis, that rebuilt the Mosul Dam in Iraq under artillery fire. We're having our own sense of artillery fire here on the coast due to red tide, blue-green algae, loss of economic jobs, as well as a threat to human health. Let's roll up our sleeves and build the projects that are going to work.
All right, so it's an election year. We are less than 2 months away. We're going to have a new governor, and there's a big Senate race. But do you get the sense that this issue is at the forefront? Is it being discussed enough?
No doubt about it. It is being discussed enough. But the talk is cheap. What we need to see are the actions that are going to be taken. Once the dust settles on November 7th and we know who emerges from these various elections, those folks need to, again, get to work and start ensuring that these projects are built in a timely manner. This idea of waiting 10 to 15 more years to build this southern reservoir, we reject that notion. It needs to be built within the next 4 years.
And the Everglades Foundation, I mean, you've spoken to both gubernatorial candidates. I mean, are you confident that they are going to try to press for a faster move on this, on the reservoir?
I am, because as the third most populous state in the nation, we rely upon 125 million tourists coming to Florida. We don't have a state income tax. We rely upon sales tax, property tax. All of that is being threatened and will continue to be threatened unless we have the next administration wanting to put their fingerprints to get us over the goal line and bring these projects that are going to have the biggest bang for the buck to fruition.
And you talk about sales tax, and this is a big part of the economy here in Florida. It is the visitors. And we saw that, again, every year we're breaking those records in visitors. So people are still coming. But, you know, do you think at some point people are like, hey, I went last year, I couldn't even spend any time on the beach, or I'm seeing these images now online of, you know, these horrible situations, and let's go somewhere else. When do you think we start to feel that?
Well, I think the biggest threat to that, if this is the new norm, if this is sustained beyond a summer or beyond a 5-6 month, 8 month time period, if this is going to be an annual problem, then that's a challenge that we're going to have to face as a state. But we can deal with this issue. We can redirect the water flowing from Lake Okeechobee. We can clean it north of the lake before it enters. We can store it south of the lake. We can make sure it flows uninhibited through the central Everglades. We're bridging Tamiami Trail. Cayo Ocho, as you head towards Naples, has 12-foot bridges so that water can get underneath to Everglades National Park. It's the replumbing of the Everglades. We need to stay the course.
Let me finish with this just real quickly. What's the next step? If the Senate goes for it, then what?
Well, it then goes to the White House. The president needs to sign the Water Resources Development Act, and as soon as his signature is on that bill, the governor of Florida, whether it's the current governor or the next, needs to begin the design of that project and start moving dirt in 2019. Folks can lend their voice to this effort by helping us let the Senate know we need to pass this bill, texting the word water to 52886, 52886, and let Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell hear that we need to move the word a bill in the Senate, and let's get this reservoir built once and for all.
Been talked about for quite some time, as you said. Eric Eichenberg, CEO of the Everglades Foundation. Eric, always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We'll stay on this story a lot. Well, still to come, high school football is underway in South Florida, but what's the latest on concussion research? We'll learn more about that coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the high school football season is underway for thousands of students across South Florida. For parents of players, there are a number of considerations for this year's season. The politics surrounding the NFL and the national anthem, balancing academics with their practices, and, of course, concerns surrounding concussions. Over the next several weeks, we will have a number of conversations with coaches, players, medical professionals, and parents involved in high school football programs. Today, we're going to hear from Dr. Jillian Hotz, director of the University of Miami's concussion program at the UHealth Sports Medicine Institute. Dr. Hotz is coordinating with high school sports programs across Miami-Dade County to confirm athletic trainers are up to speed on the latest concussion protocols. Now, her team is also conducting innovative new research on concussion treatment, including a pill that has CBD, a pain relief chemical found in medical marijuana. We spoke with her at her office at the University of Miami.
I think we're at the beginning of this. We can only diagnose CTE still at autopsy. We are trying to improve technology to have some sort of markers along the way as people do take injury and do recover or take multiple injuries. I also think that you're right. It's more at the professional level, not so much college, high school, and there's really nothing going on at the youth level.
Remind us, too, by the way, what CTEs are.
So it's, you know, looking, again, only it can be diagnosed at autopsy, and it's an increase of protein called tau, and this is what they're finding on very specific pathology reports and also in laboratory-type findings, you know, when brains are examined. So we have a long way to go with this. I know there's a lot of labs and research facilities across the country working on different imaging or markers, especially some biomarkers, which is serum and protein levels, to look at hallmark of concussion-type injuries.
Do you get the sense that players, the coaches, the parents, that they under—I mean, look, this is—it's a national discussion, but do you get the sense that they're even talking about it, or that they want to even think about it?
No, I still think it's the C word. I still think that kids are going to play through if they're not hauled off the field by somebody that says, hey, wait a minute, you know, you don't look so good. You know, we see kids every week in clinic, and I say to them, so what happened? Oh, it was first quarter, but I played through the game. Okay, you know. So, you know, we're sort of like used to them sucking it up and playing through. What I think is happening is that people on the sidelines, especially here in Dade County, we're able to train and have specific workshops for these athletic trainers. They're better at identifying the symptoms and also really knowing their players because they're there full time. So I think the identification's better. And then also the information to the coaches. Coaches are certified now. USA Football does a good job doing that. So I think just the information's out there and it's repeated on a yearly basis.
I remember talking to you a couple years ago, and there was a young woman, a soccer player, in your office, and she had had a concussion, and she was going through the testing, and you told her she wasn't going to be able to play that weekend, and her mother was upset, and they kept talking about how dad would be upset. But how often do you run into this? Where's the pressure coming from? Is it peer pressure? Is it the coach's pressure? Is it the parents? Where's the pressure for these kids to just keep playing, play through it, no matter what?
Yeah, there are definitely some parents that, you know, just have trouble accepting that their child has had this injury, which you can't see. So they look fine, you know. They may not have their swagger or their bounce that they have, or their personality may not be exactly the same. But, you know, parents still say, suck it up and get back on there. And these are some parents that are sort of played in their day or, you know, have expectations that, you know, their child may go to play in college or professional level. And then it's also, you know, the coaches too, right? There's a lot of pressure from coaches that, you know, you're my best player and we can't lose you this week. So those discussions, you know, still go on. But I think, you know, we're trying to educate the athletes. I've got a couple ex-NFL players that go out and help us educate our high school players so they can relate to them and they can make them understand that, you know, it's not a bad thing that you go and tell somebody you have a headache, because if you don't, you're just going to, you know, get a worse headache and you're going to keep getting hit. So you might as well get out now and recover and then go back to play.
There was a story in Education Week, and it was basically saying it's time to end football in high school. It talked about the risk of serious or continuous concussive blows to the head, the long-term health implications, and they even questioned whether educators' jobs, you know, are to protect children. And I'm just curious what you think about that. I mean, there are head injuries in a lot of sports. It's not just football, but football is the one that I guess is really center of this debate, though. But I don't know. What's your take on just overall safety? And you know, is it really the job of the educator to protect kids? And do we have to go that far?
Contact sports, I think, are being looked at differently, whether it's hockey, soccer, football. Again, I think it's up to the way that coaches and technique is delivered. I think we are doing a much better job now, even with soccer, of heading the ball after, you know, 13, how to head the ball. Hockey, same thing. There's been some policy changes. Football, I think heads up, the heads up program, teaching the right technique at a very young age. I think these are all really positive things. There's some kids that this is all they want to do. They want to play hockey, football, soccer, and, you know, why ruin that dream? I don't think we have a lot of data still for youth, high school, even college, to see, you know, what the effects are down the road. I think that we're just at the beginning of all of this. And also, it's a family decision, because it's really, you know, parents that have the responsibility to manage their kids. And the same thing I always say is, like, would you drop your child off at a swimming pool without a lifeguard? And so why would you drop them off at a hockey rink or a soccer field or a football field without somebody properly trained to manage your children?
I'm speaking with Dr. Jillian Hotz, director of the University of Miami's Concussion Program, and we're talking at the UHealth Sports Medicine Institute. We're looking at issues surrounding head injuries in high school football and other sports and what medical advancements have been made in diagnosing concussions. What do you tell parents and teachers, and I wonder what coaches are trained in, as to what they're supposed to be looking for? What kind of symptoms are you supposed to be looking for that may tell you that there could be some kind of problem here, that they may have had a concussion? As you said, sometimes you don't know that you've had a concussion.
So, you know, the whole myth is you don't have to have a loss of consciousness to have a concussion. You don't have to be blacked out. Just the acceleration, deceleration, or more of like a whiplash type injury could cause symptoms. So it's really watching, you know, the best you can, these plays. And of course, it's one athletic trainer, you know, that's covering a whole field, so you're not going to see everything. But, you know, if somebody does take a hard hit, they get up slow, they look dazed, they walk to the wrong side of the field, they, you know, sort of walk back to the bench with a glazed over look, I think, you know, those are the type of kids that you really have to sit on the bench and start evaluating and examining. And it's probably best to have them not return to play and be checked out. I think we know a lot more about how to treat symptoms. And most, 85% of kids that sustain these type of injuries recover within 10 to 12 days. It's really the 12% or so that may go on to have longer term issues. But again, if I had to say one thing to a listening audience, is if you do have any of these symptoms, rather go and get checked out early, acutely, than wait a month with headaches.
And I wanted to go over, you know, what the protocol is here in South Florida, because as you said, the trainers are now trained that if they see something, that kid's got to be yanked, and then they've got to go through tests. They can't go back and play until they've gone through a series of tests, right?
Sure. There's a protocol. So we have a six-step protocol, and it all starts with before the season. So it's the education and the workshop for the athletic trainers and the directors and coaches, and then it's baseline testing. We have a neurocognitive baseline test. We use IMPACT, which looks at your ability for memory, reaction time, processing speed. So we'll get that before the season, and then if there is a concussion, within 72 hours we'll have another test like that, which the athletic trainer puts the athlete in front of a computer. There's a clinic appointment. They come and actually see a clinic. We have a neuro-based clinic. We're all neuro-type people, so we're looking at things like headache, dizziness, paying attention, focus, memory. These are some of the things that are very important to take a look at post-injury. And then if they are asymptomatic, then we gradually put them back to play. The days are really gone where somebody's been out of play for 2 weeks and you say, okay, you know, just you're in the next game on Tuesday and it's Monday.
There were some stories that had come out in the last couple of years about a concussion pill. What is that exactly? And I mean, is this something that has any kind of promise?
Well, that's a big research study we have here. We're really interested in looking at the effects of CBD, cannabinoid. We hear a lot about medical marijuana, the marijuana plant, and the positive effects this has, but nobody's really studied it. And we know that CBD is really good for pain, anxiety, headache. So why not do a systematic review of this and really find out, is this something good that we could be using that really is very positive? It's more naturalistic, has a lot of health benefits, but we need to study it. So we need to know how safe it is, dosing. You know, maybe you will be going to CVS or Walgreens one day and there will be an aisle for somebody who has concussion symptoms and maybe there will be a pill on the shelf. But I think we really are at the beginning of studying this. We're just in preclinical here.
That was Dr. Jillian Hotz, director of the University of Miami's Concussion Program. We're going to continue our reporting on high school football here on Sundown. You can find more information on our website, WLRN.org. And just a note, you're listening to artist Shira Lee. She was the first performer as part of our new signature segment, Live from the 305. You can see a video of Shira performing in the WLRN studio on our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. And you can see videos from last year's season, WLRN.org. Next week, we'll meet the funk band Lemon City Trio. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Dade Heritage Trust is cleaning house. The Historic Preservation Center is making room for a new and permanent exhibit that will showcase the early history of Miami medicine and Dr. James Jackson. There will be dozens of books on history, 1920s architecture, publications, antique light fixtures, and historic artwork for sale at the Dade Heritage Trust first ever book and attic sale. I'm going to get that right. Christine Rupp, the Dade Heritage Trust Executive Director, is here today to talk about this, this really cool event. Again, it's coming up this Saturday, but let's learn more about it briefly. Christine, by the way, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here, Louis. Thanks, you.
Tell us about the history real quickly of the Dade Heritage Trust building. It's a Thursday. I'm going to get this right. I'm tongue-tied.
That's okay. I understand it. It is Thursday. To me, it feels like Friday. But anyways, our lovely building is located on Brickell Bay Drive in Southeast 12th Terrace, and it was the original office of Dr. James Jackson, who was Miami's first physician. He was the official physician for the Florida East Coast Railroad, so he worked for Henry Flagler, and of course, he's the namesake for Jackson Memorial Hospital. Our building was constructed in 1905, and it's interesting because it originally resided in downtown Miami. In 1916, Dr. Jackson decided he wanted to live south of the river, and so he put his building, this office and his home, up for sale. The person that purchased them was going to tear them down. So it was really interesting that it was kind of one of Miami's first acts of preservation. Instead of allowing the buildings to be demolished, he moved them, and he was going to move them over to Miami Beach. They got as far as being set on barges at the end of Flagler Street in the bay. And then the gentleman that owned the property where the building currently sits bought them and moved them there. So where we're located today at 190 Southeast 12th Terrace was turned into a residence. Jackson never actually practiced medicine in that location, but the building remains in exactly the same condition as it started.
And now you want to turn it into a permanent exhibit.
Correct. We are open, in addition to being the headquarters for Dade Heritage Trust, we're also an official visitor center for the city of Miami. And so we welcome, obviously, Brickell residents and tourists from all over the world. And so in an effort to teach people about our mission, which is based on historic preservation, we include exhibits that help tell people about our mission and also feature architecture and the heritage of Miami-Dade County.
So you decided to, I mean, as I said, clean house. You're getting rid of some of the old stuff. I mean, what's some of the stuff that you're going to have? And this is a special sale that you're having.
It is. It's a special sale. I'm going to tell you this, through the years, as many historic institutions will tell you, that people donate books or objects because they don't really know what else to do with them. And we have some lovely publications, some that are out of print. from various authors in Miami and really around the country, and as you said, based on architecture, preservation, history, interior design, landscape design. We even have some old cookbooks that feature South Florida recipes. So I think for book lovers, this is a really great opportunity to get your hands on a book that you may not find anywhere else.
I can only imagine it's got to be tough to sift through all this stuff and decide what you're not going to keep.
Well, we do. We sorted through, and I had a couple volunteers come down and assist. So we have our Date Heritage Trust archival pile that's not going anywhere. We have some very special, which we're calling elite books, that we found that were worth up to $500, some of these publications.
Wait, what's an elite book?
An elite book means it's expensive.
And okay, good. That's good.
Yeah. We researched those both on Google and Amazon. So we compared, and of course, eBay, because we wanted to know what they were selling for. So we have some very pricey books, too. So again, some of these are just one of a kind. They're out of print. You won't find them anywhere else.
Tell me about at least one of them.
Okay. So we have this book on early Miami pioneers, and it's so interesting because it was obviously a typewriter was used for the print. Remember that old print? I can't even, old English or whatever it is, you know, when you were typing away on the old keys. And it lists all of these early Miami families from 1840. So you see names of people, and then you say, okay, that's who that street was named after, or that's who that particular building was named after. So a very early census, 1840. It even has the first list of jurors in Dade County when Miami was finally made the county seat. So it's fascinating because you really get to take a look at old Miami, and you see through the years the influence that these early families had.
How is the sale going to work? And again, it's Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Right. Well, just come on in, view our building. If you have never seen it, it's lovely. And if you love old buildings, you'll love the DHT headquarters. And so just come on in, browse through the books. They're in no particular order. I kind of think the messy look is best because it encourages people to, you know, root through what we have. And then you'll just pick out your book or objects, and we'll check you out.
And you might find one of those elite books.
That's right.
As you said. Tell me about the exhibit that you want to put there.
Sure. Because the way the building is set up, when you walk in the building, there are two waiting rooms. Remember, this was constructed when Miami was very segregated, so the waiting rooms were segregated as well. And then when you get past those two waiting rooms, there are actually white-tiled procedure rooms. It was an office and surgery, and back then, Dr. Jackson did everything from birthing babies to fixing your eyes or dentistry work. So we have some old medical tools from Jackson. We have old furnishings. We have old medicine bottles and books that he probably would refer to as he was, you know, trying to figure out how to make you feel better. So we're going to exhibit all of those objects. The exhibit is curated by a museum professional. It'll be produced by museum professionals, and it will become part of our educational program that we've developed at Dade Heritage Trust too.
And when is that going to be ready?
That is going to open on October 25th.
That's a quick turnaround then. And this is, I mean, you know, because it's not just, I mean, it's for anybody to go and enjoy, but you talk about the educational program. It's for children also, for a lot of children that come in attendance.
Well, what we did last year, because I believe that education is key to teaching kids about the history of Miami and the importance of saving these buildings that help tell the story of our community, we developed a new educational program called Historic Places, Green Spaces. So we focused on historic buildings that are within parks or have an environmental component. So it affords us to teach kids about history, architecture, and also get them to enjoy the environment. This particular facet of our educational program will include a visit to Dade Heritage Trust headquarters, where they'll review two exhibits that we have on display. We also have a beautiful native garden out front. We have butterflies flying around Brickell. And then they will also go over to the bay, where in conjunction with a group called the Miami Waterkeepers, we're going to teach kids about the environmental impacts of our population on the bay and why it's necessary to keep Biscayne Bay healthy.
All right. Again, this Saturday, it's the Bill Kanatic sale this Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And as you said, I mean, there's all kinds of, really for every kind of collector, you got a little bit of everything.
Little bit of everything. Come on in.
So if you want to add to the collection, this is the place to check it out. Christine Rupp, again, the executive director of the Dade Heritage Trust. Christine, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Have a great sale.
We will.
All right, that's the program for today, this Thursday, September 20th. By the way, just to mention, our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. Go balo.com if you want to learn more. Remember, you can always find us online, WLRN.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We always love to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the program. Also, if you've got ideas, tell us about stories and topics that we should be covering here in South Florida. Everything from Palm Beach County down to the Keys. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you again on Monday.